3 weeks in October 2002,
a time seared into our memories.
But stepping over the line, shooting a kid, I guess it's getting to be really, really personal now.
Absolute horror. This isn't supposed to happen in a community like this.
As two murderous snipers encircled the Washington, D.C. area, a time when we all realized that our life or death in those 22 days was just a matter of chance.
Welcome back to 3 Weeks of Hell, the D.C. Snipers. I'm Bob Barnard, Fox 5 reporter here in D.C., and this is our final episode of this true crime podcast series.
And I'm Melanie Allnwick. So we've taken you through the last 3 weeks, really kind of going back over what happened and people's feelings about it. We're revisiting those anxiety-filled days and also learning some new information and breaking new ground. But now we have arrived on the night of and the morning after capture. It was October 23rd, 2002, when those names first came out. And Bob, you and I were just talking about our recollections of that night. And I vividly remember it was the end of my shift. So I'd already worked till 11:30 or something like that. And we get back to the assignment desk and the pictures are on the news.
Of the suspects
now.
Yeah,
we've got them. Everybody's got them. And the assignment desk says to me, we have a name. We have a name and we have an address. And they gave me the address and my photographer, Joe Spivak, and I were told to go knock on the door. Go up to the what we believed at the time was the sniper's residence in Clinton, Maryland. It was his wife's house. But at the time, that was the address that was connected with John Muhammad.
And you didn't know where he was, right? I mean, it turns out they were sleeping in the rest stop. But at that time,
we didn't know
go knock on the guy's door.
It was terrifying. And it was one of those things where you take a deep breath and you say, all right, this is my job. I have to go and do this. Let's just go. We said we're going to go check it out and see.
And what'd you do?
We drove to the neighborhood. It was dark, drove around a cul-de-sac, thinking, okay, do we knock on the door? Has anyone else been here? And a neighbor came out of the next door townhouse and said, they're all gone.
Oh, wow.
And so we called back, reported to the station. And what I also recall is then getting back to the station and going home, driving up 270 and seeing police car after police car after police car just speeding past me. And I thought to myself, something's going on.
And they're heading north
on
270.
They're heading north on 270. And I thought to myself, I should chase. Something's happening. But at the time, I didn't have a cell phone with a camera. Nobody had anything. I just thought, well, what am I supposed to do, me by myself? And at that point, they'd gone so far ahead of me, I had no idea where they'd gone.
And they were heading north to Frederick, Maryland, Myersville, which is just kind of west of Frederick, Maryland, well north of D.C. by about 50 miles. It was at a rest stop that they were found sleeping in their car. And it was not long after their names and the car description, the Caprice description,
right,
were put on the news the night of October 23rd. It was early morning, late night, the 23rd into the 24th. I was called early the next morning and told, you know, they've got him. Get up. So, you know, I'm waking up in the dark, still heading up that way. By the time I got to the rest stop, they were gone. But it was amazing. And as you mentioned, that the house, we learned in our previous episode that Mildred Muhammad and her kids, the ex-wife, that was their address in Clinton, Maryland. They were already, you know, taken away by the FBI. So there was nobody there, as it turns out. Thank goodness for you and
right,
Joe Spivak. But the snipers were found sleeping in their car at a rest stop, and basically, it was all over. It was a combination of good police work, the outreach from the killers themselves, and their life of crime preceding their D.C. area killing spree that would eventually solve the case. Here is retired ATF Special Agent Mike Bouchard.
Malvo had been calling the hotlines and different things, didn't think that people were taking him seriously. After the Ponderosa shooting in Ashland, Virginia, Malvo we were supposed to call them back. Their note was, call us at this number in the morning. But we had taken the note because it was sealed. We had to do DNA and fingerprint. So by the time we opened it and saw it, they wanted us to call them like 8 in the morning. The time had passed. Fortunately, they were off by one number on the number they left us, which was a payphone. So we had to go out and surreptitiously say, you know, we tried you at the number, and they thought we were messing with them. So Malva then called a priest in Ashland and, you know, started talking about, we're the ones, can you get the message to them? We're the shooters from Montgomery. And it was interesting, they called a Catholic priest, you know, about God. And then we started putting things together, like God, all these different things are always mentioning God. It's somebody who has faith. I don't know how somebody with faith would be killing people, but, you know, at this, so the priest passed that message on, and they just said Montgomery. So it was Montgomery County, Montgomery, Alabama. So, you know, the investigators started looking at all the different, possible shootings in Montgomery, found Montgomery, Alabama, had an unsolved shooting at a convenience store where a woman was shot and killed. But a victim, another victim saw, a witness saw the shooter run away and dropped a magazine, as in a catalog. And there was an identifiable fingerprint in that magazine. They ran it against the databases, nothing came back. So we then ran it against the immigration database and had a hit on Malvo when he came into the country. So then we said, you know, with Malvo, who did he come into the country with? You know, John Williams, or John Muhammad. So then we started looking at John Muhammad. But at the same time, we had a tip from Tacoma, Washington, Robert Holmes, who said, hey, I used to live with some people up here. A guy used to shoot into a tree stump. He had a kid with him. He used to call him Sniper. Well, what was his name? So that's when we, that was the day before Conrad Johnson was shot. So we're putting all these pieces together. You know, by then we're trying to find the car that Muhammad might have had, running DMV. So everything was coming together. Unfortunately, it didn't come together in time for before Mr. Johnson was shot.
That's fascinating. That, and pretty good thinking on your guys' part to hear Montgomery and not just assume Montgomery County.
Yeah, it was, you know, we had a whole group of investigators. I think we, given time, we had 1,000 people working on this throughout the country. So, you know, the ops team did an outstanding job following leads and categorizing leads and prioritizing leads is probably the best term. So they get all the credit for pulling that together.
Thinking like, okay, maybe Montgomery, Alabama, and then, oh my gosh, and then finding a fingerprint on a magazine. Mm-hmm. And then when the name Sniper was used in Tacoma, Washington, and then did you match that up to Lee Malvo? And then you knew you had the guys?
Well, we suspected Malvo was the one, the kid that was had the nickname Sniper. We were following up with Mr. Holmes at the time, sent teams out there to his house. They were supposed to do it quietly and cut the tree stump out, but everybody showed up with their agency jackets on, and it became a, like, now this is on TV. Now if these guys are watching, they got an idea we're on to them. Of course, if they know we're on to them, then they get rid of the gun, just go into the wind. I mean, that was a real blow to the investigation by the way they approached that out there. But fortunately, I don't think these guys saw it on TV, and we were able to stay quietly and look for them, you know, quietly.
But you had a fear that your window to catch them was narrowing.
After I saw that video with everybody with their agency jackets, I thought, we're done. These guys, are, if they have half a brain, they're going to be gone, and the murder weapon's going to be gone.
And yet it wasn't.
No.
John Allen Muhammad, a 42-year-old Army and Desert Storm veteran, and Lee Boyd Malvo, a 17-year-old from Jamaica who'd been befriended by Muhammad in the Caribbean and considered him a father-like figure. They were both arrested sleeping in their 1990 blue Chevy Caprice at a rest stop, as I mentioned, in Myersville, Maryland, about 50 miles north of Washington, D.C.
We've also learned the vehicle that they're looking for, and let's show you what that looks like. It is a burgundy or blue Chevy sedan. It's a Caprice, it's a 1990 model with a New Jersey license plate. We've learned here on the scene that that does go back to a Clinton, Maryland address.
A trucker who heard the suspect's vehicle description spotted the car and the two men sleeping inside and called police, using his truck to block the rest stop exit just in case. When police arrived and surrounded the car, Muhammad and Malvo were still asleep. They'd been captured.
A lot has happened in just the past 24 hours as the sniper manhunt literally went nationwide.
We have team coverage tonight from one coast to the other. We begin with Fox 5's Bob Bonnard live at police headquarters in Rockville. What a day, Bob.
Incredible day, Tracy. We're still waiting to hear from Chief Moose. In fact, he hasn't said anything publicly about this morning's arrest.
Found with them in the car, the Bushmaster semi-automatic rifle used during the killing spree. ATF agent Mike Bouchard says the key was getting an arrest warrant for Muhammad on a weapons charge.
So, we went back and forth. Now we knew what the vehicle he was driving. We went back and forth, should we release this to the press? Because if we do, they might see this on TV. Because we know they're watching the press conferences. And it would be big news if they said we're going to identify who we're looking for. So we knew they would be watching. So we went back and forth, should we do it? We said, basically, let's just give it 24 hours. We also were worried about possible vigilantes going out looking for them. So we said, let's just wait. But in the back of our mind, we knew someone was going to leak it. And sure enough, within like an hour, it got leaked. In fact, there's one person who worked on the case that has written a book claiming he purposely leaked it, which I'm like, you know, there's a chain of command and there's also strategies that are involved in these kind of cases. You don't just make those decisions at a ground level.
So you believe this person was telling the truth, that he was the leaker?
Yeah.
And who was that?
He was a former U.S. Marshal, and he's proud of it. So he's done podcasts, you know, claiming I'm the one that did it, and because of me, it got solved. Well, we lucked out, you know, that it got out, and we were fortunate that a service worker saw their vehicle parked at a rest stop, and he was sharp enough to pick up on it and called it in.
It was incredibly fortunate. Montgomery County State's Attorney John McCarthy, then the legal advisor to the task force, says that leak put everything at risk.
Because one of the things they feared was with the leak, if they thought, for instance, that we had a tag number, what if they got rid of the murder weapon? What if they had gotten rid of the car? What if they destroyed the computer? What if they threw away the walkie-talkies? When they were ultimately arrested, the car was a treasure trove of all the information you needed to make this case. If you didn't have the gun that you could tie ballistically to these killings, where would you have been? If you didn't have the walkie-talkies, if you didn't have the car that had the cutout where the car trunk could pop up and you could put the muzzle of the weapon out the car on a bipod that would sit there like a sniper sitting in a nest ready to take a shot, what if you lost all that? Trying to balance it out, you wanted to catch them, but you wanted to catch them in a situation where you would have evidence that you could actually convict them. And obviously stopping the killings was foremost in it, but the way it went down, literally once you saw what was in that car, look, that was a really solid case. It wasn't a tough case to make because the forensics so clearly tied them to the killings.
pumping gas, going to the grocery store, stopping at an ATM. As news of the sniper suspect arrest sinks in, life is beginning to return to normal.
I'm excited. It's another sense of freedom to me that I can go in there and enjoy a cup of coffee on the patio again on Connecticut Avenue.
The last couple weeks I've not stopped for a bagel or coffee or anything. I've kind of just gone to the office and got there as quick as possible. So feel a little bit better.
It was the end of a three-week period unlike any in the D.C. region's history.
You know, the final night when we announced all these, tying this together, that was probably the most emotional, one of the most emotional days, because, you know, we prepared for that all day and made sure we could inform the victims. And my job was to go out and say which shootings had been tied to this rifle and these two guys. But when we walked out, you know, they had Girl Scouts, people were cheering, crying. A lot of the media, we were facing them. A lot of them were crying. And it was just like, you know, thank God this whole thing's over. So that was, you know, a good way to end this whole thing, that, you know, everybody was appreciative and, you know, big relief that everybody can get back to their normal life.
John McCarthy vividly remembers how everyone felt a weight had been lifted.
I remember that Halloween night. And the reason I remember it, it just seemed like everyone who had been bottled up in their house, it's almost like a post-COVID kind of phenomenon, everyone was in the street. I lived in a neighborhood, wagon, people were pulling their kids into wagons, everyone's out in the streets. People were drinking wine, they were having a glass of beer, everyone is partying in the street, hanging out with their kids. It was just wonderful. It was one of those, I think it was my favorite Halloween that I ever had. And it was just, there was such relief in the community. And it was amazing to me how quickly the community rebounded to a sense of normalcy. Because we went from hiding in our houses for 3 weeks to all of a sudden the world was out on the street.
Our first glimpse of suspect John Muhammad was recorded by somebody in a nearby office building as the suspects were brought out for arraignment after questioning.
You looked up. Everywhere you look was faces of individuals. Everybody worked in those buildings had come to the windows to watch this happen. They're applauding, they're screaming, they're banging on the windows, cheering them, the police and the law enforcement individuals who were taking the people out of there. It really was it was very emotional. I mean, first of all, I don't think I'd slept for 3 days, so it might have been more emotional for me because I hadn't slept. But it was amazing to watch this happen, because it was almost like they were being led out of the Coliseum into these crowds of people that just were so relieved, because I think by then word is beginning to trickle out. Arrests have been made, the snipers are in custody, and the people that are in these buildings are putting two and two together and realize this is the guy that's terrified us for the last 3 weeks. And it was very cathartic for, I think, for those people, and very very nice for them to be so supportive of the police.
But for prosecutors, both at the state and federal level, there was nothing normal about this case.
When John Muhammad was arrested, the questioning occurred not at the former police facility, because there was too much media there. They took him to another location off of Goody Drive in Rockville. And John Muhammad was in one room being interrogated by one interrogator, and Malvo was in another room being interrogated by another. You could watch, they had set it up so that you could remotely watch it or listen into what was happening. Basically, couldn't do both. Now, if you watch John Muhammad's interview, I had two thoughts. At the time, John Muhammad essentially took over the interview. He began asking all the questions. And at the time, I thought it was John Muhammad trying to find out, as many bad guys will do, what do they have on me? What's the information they have? He was asking Jim Drury, which is fine because he's talking, and Jimmy's a brilliant investigator. He was letting him talk and ask questions. I thought Muhammad was trying to find out how much information, he was denying everything, by the way, but how much information do you have about what I did, and can you prove that I am the DC sniper? I've come to believe, in hindsight, that was more because he is a psychopath. He needed to be a dominant personality. Classic psychopathic behavior is taking over an interview. He needed to be in charge of the interview. And so that was much more consistent with his personality. He had a grandiose sense of his own intelligence. We saw that reflected later on when he waived, when he fired his attorneys on multiple occasions and tried to represent himself in various trials, either in Virginia and Maryland. He thought he was smart enough that he could do it and do a better job than the lawyers. He thought he was a very bright guy. He made some terrible mistakes, that goes back to your original question, but he always thought he was the smartest person in the room.
So you said that that Malvo actually tried to escape?
Yeah, what happened was these were not secure facilities, and the two men were both separated, and Malvo was handcuffed, but they handcuffed him to a chair, but like to a chair leg, and he was sitting at a table in a room that had a drop ceiling with ceiling tiles in it, and he was left alone for just a couple of minutes in the room because the interrogators were trying to get together a game plan. Mm-hmm. They're game planning. How are we going to do this? What's our strategy going to be? And Jim Drury's over here, and Terry Ryan is with Malvo. And when they went back in to interview Malvo, Malvo was gone. He had gotten the handcuffs off of the chair, put the chair on the table, and he had climbed up into the roof through the ceiling tiles. He was gone. And so they had to recapture him because he had escaped up into the ceiling.
What does that tell you about him, or what?
Well, I guess he was desperate. I don't know what kind of training he'd had from. Look, he was daring enough to try and escape. Look, he'd been brought in by lots of guys looking like military paratroopers. This was a military style kind of operation to arrest them. So he knew that this was serious business. I guess he knew what he had done more so than any of us knew at that point in time. And he tried to get away. But he wasn't successful. He went back up and they caught him. He's crawling around in the office building. But like, what the heck?
The father of murder victim Lorianne Lewis Rivera spoke out after the arrests.
The job our judicial system should have is to remove this detriment from our society permanently.
Let's go right now to Fox 5's Bob Barnard for the latest in the investigation. He is outside the Justice Department. Bob?
Bad blood is running like a river behind the scenes tonight, Brian. Behind the scenes, prosecutors in Maryland and Virginia were battling for the right to try the sniper suspects first. Here at the Justice Department, we're told Attorney General John Ashcroft will decide where to send the suspects for trial sometime next week. Some thinking the government's best case would be the shooting death of FBI analyst Linda Franklin at the Home Depot in Falls Church, Virginia. Here's more of my report from 20 years ago. Fairfax County Commonwealth's Attorney Robert Horan this week said he wants the case and believes this shooting offers the best opportunity for suspects John Muhammad and Lee Malvo to get the death penalty.
Certainly, at this juncture, you've got to leave open that possibility for both of them, depending on what the evidence is as to who the shooter is and how it all works.
Robert Horan, the longtime Fairfax County Commonwealth's attorney you just heard there, died recently at age 90. He would end up getting the case against Lee Malvo, prosecuting it successfully, the jury delivering a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Part of the team defending Lee Malvo were two Northern Virginia defense attorneys, Thomas Walsh and Mark Petrovich.
We were like everyone else. We were in the middle of the terrorist acts, essentially, that everybody was experiencing, and we were at the pumps shucking and jiving and moving around and trying to avoid potential snipers. And we tell this story all the time. We had come off another capital murder trial, and Michael, Tom, and I had handled that case, and I had been assigned to the sentencing on that case. And we were having lunch one day in the middle of the shootings while they were still going on. And we all just were sitting there and we were joking. We said, imagine you got appointed to this case if they catch him. And imagine if you have to do the mitigation phase on that capital case. And we're all laughing. And then it was like 2 weeks later, we got appointed to the case.
And so, what was your reaction?
It was surreal. We went from one phase to the other. We were essentially part of the overall population victims, and then we went from that to defending him, which is our obligation, and that's what we do for a living. And so then our posture changed, our position changed, and our outlook changed.
We spoke to Petrovich and Walsh at their office in Fairfax, Virginia.
The police had a goal to, you know, get a full confession, paint him as a monster, and then basically try to kill him. Our goal was to come in, create a relationship, and try to save his life.
The lawyers are no longer representing Malvo. During the Virginia trial, the team presented an insanity defense, trying to convince the jury that Malvo was controlled by John Muhammad.
It was very clear initially that he was still operating under a mandate from Muhammad. Muhammad had told him, and one of the reasons he confessed when he was first brought to Virginia, that was one of the battles we had, one of the legal battles was the statement he made. He confessed to and claimed he was the shooter on all the shootings, and that was a directive by Muhammad. And they decided that he would take the blame for all the shootings because it would be unlikely that they would seek the death penalty against a juvenile, whereas they would seek the death penalty against Muhammad. So that first statement was a big obstacle for us, and that was, we were fighting that the whole time because he basically bared all and essentially admitted and took responsibility for all the shootings, which wasn't the case at all. He apparently did a few of the shootings, but not the vast majority were Muhammad. And so that was the mandate and the layer we were trying to peel back, the indoctrination and control that Muhammad had over Lee. It was very apparent, and we had to work through that and work that down.
John Muhammad would be tried by Prince William County, Virginia prosecutors for the murder of Dean Myers, the 53-year-old Vietnam veteran and civil engineer shot and killed gassing up his car at a Sunoco station in Manassas, Virginia on October 9, 2002. Former Commonwealth's attorney Paul Ebert prosecuted Muhammad. We asked Mr. Ebert about the sniper case when he announced his retirement in 2019.
And anybody in this metropolitan area that wasn't afraid, there's something wrong with them.
Were you afraid?
To some degree. I mean, I wasn't going to run and hide like a lot of people did, but when I'd pump gas, I'd walk around and say, if he kills me, it's going to be a moving target.
Muhammad would be convicted in April 2005, sentenced to death, and executed by lethal injection on November 10, 2009. Malvo actually testified against Muhammad in the Maryland trials more than 3 years after he'd been separated from the influence of his former father figure. This time, he said he was the trigger man in only two of the shootings, and Muhammad did all the rest. Malvo pleaded guilty without a plea deal to all of the charges in Maryland.
Lee was a really good kid growing up, and he got bounced around to a number of different places in Jamaica and then Antigua, and he just never got the settled home that he wanted. He wanted the love of his father initially, and his father couldn't cohabitate with his mother, so he essentially abandoned Lee. And then Lee was with his mother, and his mother just had too much for her to deal with. She was trying to get employment, she was trying to make a living, and at the same time raise a child, and it was too much for her. So she kept leaving him in households, people who she knew, relatives, and good households, and places where Lee enjoyed staying. But after a short period of time, she would come in and move him to a different place. Not to say that she was doing it for an evil purpose. She was trying to get herself together and get a steady situation for herself. But this had an effect on Lee. He never had that steady father figure. He never had that nice home that he wanted. And he didn't have the promise of a good education. And unfortunately, he met Muhammad, who was, as Craig described him, a child magnet. He was very good with adolescent kids, and Lee took right to him, and he became his disciple essentially, and was completely indoctrinated. Lee would never have done any of this had it not been for Muhammad. No question. I don't think there's any question about that. I would say he was a really good kid. He was born and raised in Jamaica. And he got bounced around, but he was a really good kid. And then he met somebody who I do consider a monster at that time. He met a monster who indoctrinated him and caused him to essentially ruin his life.
Interesting how both of his then trial lawyers say that had Lee Malvo never met John Muhammad, who knows where he would be today, but he would not be in prison.
And I think we heard a lot of that in some of the testimony at the trial, which I covered also some 20 years ago. And also with me was our Fox 5 producer, Terry Tolliver. And I wanted you guys to hear from her as well, because she also traveled just the entire path that Lee Boyd Malvo took with John Muhammad through his young life. She went with Tracy Neal. You've heard her.
Her voice throughout this, one of our anchors.
In our podcast as well. And so they really wanted to go and get a sense of the same sort of thing. Who was this teenage sniper?
And it was just really just eye-opening to see, like, his really, really humble beginnings. I mean, you know, we're talking about, like, kind of a beach shack where he and his mom were. It was beautiful, but, you know, it wasn't the touristy things that we see when you go to Antigua. In Jamaica, it was really, really where we got a chance to really see what was surrounding, like, this whole, like, how it was that Muhammad was able to really get control of Malvo. We set up an interview with his mom, and we went to Jamaica specifically to talk to her. She was in the country at the time. And once when we got there, she wanted hair and makeup. She wanted us to spend $5,000 on a hotel resort for us to do the interview. She wanted a clothing budget. And, you know, it really spoke to how she viewed her son. We were giving her the opportunity to tell people about him, tell people like he wasn't the monster that, you know, many people thought he was. And really, she was all about herself. She was all about money. We tried to really just get some insight on who he was and how it happened. But we really discovered that she was about getting to America. She was about materialistic things, and she really didn't have any connection to Malvo whatsoever.
And I guess from what you saw, did it kind of feel like the perfect situation for someone like a predator to come in and take advantage?
For sure, for sure. That whole grooming thing, we really got a sense of that when we went to Seattle and we went to the YMCA where they stayed. And when we went in and talked to the administration, like the people that worked at the Y, they said immediately that they could tell that this was not really a great situation for Malvo, that they would watch Muhammad kind of like training him, that he would make him run up and down like this hill outside of the Y and give him just a cup of applesauce for the day. Made him sleep on mats in the Y on the floor, and then like wake him up very early in the morning to do weights and weight training. And when John Muhammad was around, they could definitely see Malvo's personality and how he interacted just change, like just shut down. And I just, you know, it was so weird, like, because we went through that terror here, and to be standing like in the footsteps and kind of tracing this path and like seeing where they were and like hearing from people who had interacted with him, it was just like, sometimes it was just so like chilling.
If someone had called and said, something's not right about this situation, Maybe you should check into This kid's status. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I know, yeah, it's hard to believe that no one stepped in for him. I mean, we went to a neighbor's house. They were like, there was a friend that John Muhammad had, and he would go over to this friend's house. There was a stump in the backyard that he would make Malvo practice like shooting guns. And we spoke to that neighbor, and she just like, you know, she's like, the gun was bigger than he was. And, you know, to have him out in the back, and like she could hear John Muhammad yelling at him. And if he didn't hit like certain targets, you know, she saw him like throwing stuff at him, you know, like, if someone would have just, like, maybe one phone call just stepped in at some point, we would not have gone through this 3 weeks.
The murder trials for Malvo and John Muhammad, though for crimes committed in Fairfax and Prince William counties in Northern Virginia, were moved out of the area because of the pretrial publicity.
Listening to, watching Linda Franklin's husband testify was very hard. And then Conrad Johnson's wife, what a classy woman. She, remember her testifying in penalty phase? And she was just, it was just heart-wrenching. It really was. And, you know, you get the evil eye, or they call it the stink eye, and the family's looking at you, bearing down on you. And we're like, we're just trying to do our job, you know, make the system run properly. But there is really no take. The takeaway is it's just tragic. I think that's the issue.
We've done a number of capital murder cases, and they're horribly sad from every angle.
Remember Dr. Caroline Namro? She's the Montgomery County, Maryland pediatrician who witnessed the October 2nd shooting death of Prem Kumar Walaker at a gas station in Aspen Hill. She told us her story in episode 3. Dr. Namro ended up testifying at both defendants' trials.
That was very hard, and I have to say that I found the trial for Malvo very disturbing, because where the witness stand was that I was on and where the defense table was, we were very close. Just the arrangement in the courtroom. And they had dressed him up in this very nice creamy ivory colored sweater. And you know, he's a good looking guy. You know, he's a nice young man. And it's just it was just the juxtaposition of this nice looking boy who, and yet he could commit such horrendous crimes, was so shocking. It's so shocking. You know, you think of somebody who's evil, you know, they look evil, they look like a monster, and yet here he is, this nice-looking kid. That was really horrific. I found that very mentally shocking. Like, here you are, you can look nice, you can be doodling. I could see him, like, doodling on the pad that he had. And you took all these people's lives. For what? For what? Destroyed these people's lives, these families, forever changed. That was really disturbing. The trial where Mohammed was in Rockville, and he defended himself, actually, he didn't have a defense attorney. That was very bizarre, because he questioned me himself. And I think he kept asking me, well, did you see me? Did you see the card? I was like, no, I didn't. I didn't see anything. I think that's really all he asked me. I can't quite remember all the questioning, but...
He was almost paranoid that you saw him, or just curious, or whatever.
I think his point was, well, how do you know it was me? Because you didn't see me. So where's the proof?
How strange was that, though, to be having a conversation with this man at all, let alone in a courtroom with a bunch of people listening in?
Yeah, it was very bizarre. That was very, very bizarre. Here's this guilty guy, like, asking me, well, you didn't see me. Nope, I didn't. But I was only on the witness stand for a few minutes. I think that was very brief.
Iron Brown was the youngest of the sniper's victims. We met him in episode 5. Iron was called as a witness in the penalty phase of Mohammed's murder trial. Says he heard Malvo never showed any remorse.
So I never had a chance to actually meet Malvo or see him face to face, but I did get a chance to see Mohammed during the trial, and he actually was the one who had no remorse and was just, I'll never forget how he looked at me, even after the police and the FBI told me not to look his direction, but I wanted to anyway. And Malvo was the one who actually did shoot me. As I stated before, I think he was aiming at my heart, because I was shot just underneath my chest, right above my stomach. And I believe that I read somewhere that he confessed to his cellmate that had I not been outside, he would have shot into the first school bus that would have pulled into the parking lot. And ironically, my school bus used to always be the first bus that would pull into the parking lot. So I think it was inevitable that it was going to be me to be shot regardless.
My God. And so Mohammed never said anything to you? It was just kind of the way he looked at you that you remember?
I would never forget how he looked at me. He like tried to pierce through my soul almost. But Mohammed, he definitely did try to intimidate me. And I never forget how he looked at me. Because if you recall, he was representing himself during a trial that I believe was being held in Virginia. And I came there briefly to, you know, give a brief testimony, because obviously I didn't see anybody being shot through the sniper rifle. But I was just taking them you know, step for step for what happened with my aunt dropping me off and me getting out the car and things of that nature.
Paul LaRuffa is also a survivor. You heard from him in episode 2 how he was actually the first victim of the snipers back in September 2002 before anyone knew what was about to come. John Muhammad questioned him too on the witness stand. LaRuffa says he felt he was face to face with pure evil, and at the time he hated both Muhammad and Malvo. He's in a better place now.
You know, when people say, have you forgiven him? And I say, yeah. At first, you have to define forgiveness. And the definition that I use for forgiveness is a definition that states forgiveness is the release of anger towards somebody who has done you harm. So it's something that I have released the anger because, as I said before, if I had spent the last 20 years being as angry as I was 20 years ago, then I let him ruin my life.
Today, Paul is actually an advocate for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, which works to end juvenile life without parole sentences. 25 states and the District of Columbia now ban life without parole for minors. Paul believes these prisoners should at least have the opportunity to ask for release at some point in their lives.
In February 2020, then-Virginia Governor Ralph Northam signed a law that allows prisoners serving life sentences for crimes committed as juveniles, like Lee Malvo, to be eligible for parole after 20 years. Malvo's first application for parole was submitted in August of 2022. It was denied by the Virginia Parole Board. The Supreme Court has also restricted the circumstances when a young person can be sent to jail for life. State's Attorney John McCarthy says Malvo's case is always a sticking point when advocates want to go even further and eliminate kids being tried as adults.
Mr. Malvo is part of a much larger debate about juvenile justice reform and how far you should go, because you always have that case to reflect upon. It's not an imaginary, made-up example. Here's a real concrete example. What if somebody goes into a first-grade class and kills 25 first graders with an automatic weapon at age 16, wipes out a first grade class? Are they going to stay as a juvenile? Are they going to go into a program in Maryland where maybe it lasts a year? At worst, they would be incarcerated till age 21, and then they're back in the community, and they killed 25 first graders, or 22 people. You know, it's very interesting. Things have turned out, historically, things have turned out pretty well for him. He gets a review of his sentence in Virginia, and he gets a review of his sentence in Maryland. These are sentences where he thought when he took them, he agreed. He was never going to see the light of day again. He might now.
Malvo's trial lawyers don't believe the now 37-year-old serving his life sentence at Virginia's Supermax Red Onion State Prison will ever be released.
There's a lot of people out there that hope he won't. That's for sure. I hope that there's a chance of him getting out. I'm not sure that'll ever happen, though.
Malvo is suspected of murdering other people as well in Alabama, Louisiana, Arizona, and California. And so if he were to ever be released from custody in Virginia and then later Maryland, he would have to face charges in those other states as well.
Yeah, at some point in time, there is something called geriatric parole, too, you know, and so... But you're right, he has all these other states, so if you get a chance to get out of here, he's going to go to Maryland, and then he's going to have to be reviewed there. And then Louisiana and Alabama have a chance to prosecute him, no statute of limitations. In Arizona, he came forth and admitted to his involvement in various things. In California, too, Kenny Cook. So I think with all those layers... And going from state to state to state, I'm not sure he'll ever get out. But it would be nice to have that option for him because it will give him hope.
Paul LaRuffa says he might be for that in 40 or 50 years, but not now. Others whose lives were forever changed aren't sure they'll ever accept that.
I don't think he should ever be allowed out. And I know that there are people who say, well, he was very young and he was very influenced. And I agree that he was very influenced. But unfortunately, I think he enjoyed what he did. I think he was proud of what he did. And I know it's hard to think that somebody that young should stay in prison, but look what he did. I really don't think that he should be allowed out.
In retrospect, many feel that if 15-year-old Lee Boyd Malvo had never met John Muhammad, things would have been different.
100%. 100%. I think that he was a victim of a lot of different circumstances, a mom that didn't really care about him, a system that didn't protect him when he was in trouble. And then just wanting to be, I think he really wanted that acceptance and love from John Muhammad. So he was willing to do anything to get that and to keep that because he had nothing else in the world.
And I guess if you want to take away, we all should take away, do the right things with your children and make sure that they get their basic needs met and make sure that they're raised the right way and they don't get into the hands of the wrong people.
And of course, here at Fox 5, we'll be keeping an eye on how the appeals process for Malvo and his sentences and his, you know, bids for parole in the future, how that goes. Believe me, we'll be following this, you know, in the months and years to come.
And certainly what's been really interesting, I think, for both you and I over the last 9 weeks, is the ability to really get to connect with these people, people that we'd written about or heard testify or even reported on from the reporter's box, I guess,
right,
at arm's length, really being able to get those questions answered that you always have about what were they thinking? What was happening behind the scenes? I found that to be very satisfying from a journalistic point of view.
Absolutely. Like even meeting Iron Brown, who, you know, we knew his name from the time the little 13-year-old was shot outside of school. And Dr. Namro, who back in episode one, like, you know, I was talking live on TV the first morning when we were realizing something crazy was going on, that the lady in that van, we thought it was a nurse at the time, it turns out she was a doctor, was witnessing, and here we've had a chance to meet her and share her story with you. So we feel very grateful for those who've been able to share their stories and willing to do so, so that we can, you know, put that in this podcast and share it with you.
And we just want to thank you all for coming along with us over the last 9 weeks. We appreciate your time as well. Hope you enjoyed it.